Democracy is Power, Rebuilding Unions from the Bottom Up, Chapter 6, Taking Power in the Local. The campaign continues. Taking office is a perilous time for local reform caucuses, and many don't make the cut. Reformers face a whole new set of problems once in office and a gaggle of forces to push them or pull them off course. At the same time, the window of opportunity to make changes is short. If change is not evident almost immediately, it is easy for the members to become cynical. They campaigned actively, elected new officers, committed to reform, but everything seems to stay the same. Thus begins a vicious cycle. Member cynicism leads to passivity and withdrawal, which leads to greater dependence on officials, which leads to officials identifying themselves as the union that provides services to the member customers. On the other hand, the expectation of change and the new level of attention members are focusing on the union allow new officers to take actions immediately after an election that would be much harder to accomplish after everyone has settled into routine. The honeymoon period will not repeat itself. The success of reform depends on carrying the momentum and spirit of a successful election campaign into the operation of the local on a day-to-day basis. It depends on the members. The following suggestions are directed to reform leaders who have just taken office, particularly to the one designated by the Constitution as the top leader. Here we will refer to this person as the president, although in some locals the title may be principal officer, business manager, secretary, treasurer, or chairperson. With some adjustments, these suggestions are also relevant to current office holders, but they will be much more useful if reformers think these issues through long before the election. Don't wait until the votes are counted to read this chapter. The advice that follows mostly assumes a worst-case scenario, that your predecessors, we designate them the old guard, were truly uninterested in serving the members, remain hostile to your administration, and are plotting their own return to power. If your local has a less contentious atmosphere and the ex-incumbents are willing to work with you, so much the better. We've also tailored our suggestions for large to medium-sized locals with full-time officers and staff, including those who represent the members on grievances, who may be called business agents or committee persons. Although we've written in the form of advice to the top officers, success depends on the efforts of a solid reform caucus, not just a few people. That means the entire reform movement at different levels must understand and take the tasks at this critical stage of union democracy. There's a box, even before you campaign. Ideally, you'll be thinking about how you handle a leadership post before you even start an election campaign. For the campaign itself, you'll be searching out members with skills for campaign organizing and leadership. You should think about the same questions for local union work. Which members show knowledge in certain areas? Literature production, grievance handling, health and safety, running meetings, computers. How you conduct your campaign helps set the tone for the local once you take office. During the campaign, therefore, don't make promises you can't keep or that, if kept, would undermine your functioning. For example, don't promise an unlimited open-door policy. You can't be in the office and visiting work sites at the same time, and you wouldn't want to devote all your time to only those members who come to the office. Promise instead an open door during certain hours and stick to them. Now what? Congratulations, your local reform group has won an election. Now what? The goal was to make the union more powerful. You ran on a platform of member involvement and more aggressive representation. You promised more education. You denounced the cozy relationship your predecessors had with management. Perhaps you ridiculed them for never returning phone calls, and perhaps members never saw them except at election time. Now you face a stack of problems. All the normal bargaining and grievance handling of the local demand action. In fact, it may be worse than normal, since your predecessors may have left you all the messes to clean up, and little information as possible. You have dozens of committee and staff positions to reappoint, replace, or abolish, and many legal procedures and responsibilities to learn and do. And then you face the question of how to start moving toward the goals that motivated your reform group in the first place. When you try to make changes, the union structure feel like they are built of concrete. Nothing seems to give. Other times they feel like jello. They give easily, but just bounce back the way they were as soon as your attention is diverted and you relieve the pressure. Your defeated opponents may have already started a campaign to undermine you, and they have the contacts with management and with sections of the union you hardly know, as well as knowledge of the contracts and the way it's always been done. Your own supporters are inexperienced and need training. Some may be pressing you to do it all with one stroke of the pen. Others may be demanding an appointment or a pet project. Now that you're in office, crises are thrust on you both by management and by individual members that you can neither duck nor defer. It all seems overwhelming. And this is where the first mistakes are so often made. The temptation is to reduce the number of tasks by leaving things the way they are. Keep the experienced business agents and staff on. Hope they will follow the program of the election winners. Don't change the procedures. Just try to take charge of the old machine and make it your own. It won't work. You need to build a smooth-running operation that belongs to the members and that gets the right things done. The old guard's machine is part of the problem and still is. Was part of the problem and still is. The assumptions leaders become embedded in the structure they create. If the leaders do not trust the members, then their organization will be set up to protect themselves from those members. One method is withholding information about how the local operates. If the former leaders thought of unionism as a business and members as passive and uninvolved, then their structure will not serve your goal of involving members. You need to thoroughly revamp the organization. If you try to take over the old machine, at best there will be tension and nothing will happen. The local will seem less effective and the members will be demoralized. More likely, the machine will slowly but surely take you captive and the members will see you becoming like the people you beat. You'll start to believe that the only way to get anything done will be to stop rocking the boat. A lot of bad union leaders started out as reformers with good intentions. Member involvement from the get-go. First and foremost, the members want results. Many will still expect you to service them in the same old ways, only more and better. They may like nice people and be willing to give them a chance, but what they need is coordinated action and focused use of power. This means carrying out the members' program to change the status quo against both great inertia and formidable opposition. Democracy requires a powerful force. That means figuring out how you're going to build off the mobilization created for the election. The election probably involved more members in union activities than at any other time except contract votes. While you cannot expect all members to maintain this same high level of activity, many will be ready to be more involved than before, and some will continue to be very active. The task is to turn this energy and creativity into an ongoing union campaign. In dealing with all the problems you face in running a local, this task of involving, mobilizing the members must frame everything. Without it, you gradually slip back into a more competent version of business unionism. Here's one example of a small first step. When a reform movement won office in Teamsters Local 728 in Atlanta in May 1990, one of the first things the new leaders did was to ask the members to come help clean up and reorganize the union office. The cleanup was a weekend project that reinforced the feeling that the union hall now belonged to the members, while encouraging members to chip in and help the new administration. Members said they had a great time carting trash and mopping floors. Another vital invisible first step is to start or rework the union newsletter. A new piece of literature delivered to every member calls attention to new goals and new ways of meeting them. A revitalized newsletter requires coordination by someone who well understands the new administration's priorities and who has a sense of the conditions at the workplace. From the beginning, the newsletter should involve many members in its production, in planning and writing articles, as well as in its distribution. It's overwhelming to try to build a new organization all by yourself. Luckily, one of the benefits of being part of a democratic reform movement is that you don't have to do it by yourself. You won by mobilizing the energy and initiative of members, and this becomes your most important resource for running the local. In addition, you can draw on the experience and active support of reform officers in the other locals and other unions. Be familiar with any resources available from your international. Pull together the leadership team. Chances are a leadership group was formed in the course of the successful campaign, but you may need some additional skills or experience. You may want to bring in someone from another local who has been through this sort of transition to help you out in either an official or unofficial capacity. Here is a sketch of a leadership team for a medium to large local with a multi-person staff. Getting beyond a one-person show. The top executive function should really be 2 to 4 people working together and led by the president. These people should support the goals of the reform movement, regularly share information, and have confidence in each other's decisions so that they can function separately and still in a unified fashion. They can fill each other's shoes when necessary. Depending on a local, these may be the top officers, but may also include appointed executive assistants or other officers. These must be people who can function as part of a team rather than engaging in self-promotion. Take group direction and criticism. Give honest feedback and criticism to the president. Listen well to the members and report accurately. They should have strengths and expertise in areas that complement those of the president. Members of this executive group should be able to make decisions delegated by the president. For example, the president may delegate most actual decisions about lost time approval to an assistant without changing what the bylaws say about that authority. The buck still stops with the president, who has to take responsibility for the actions of the appointee, but everyone understands that the assistant has real authority because they are backed by the president. In many locals, the board is little more than a rubber stamp. It can be turned into a real leadership body by bringing as many questions as possible to the board in the initial stages of sounding them out. Board members should have areas of responsibility beyond the board meetings, perhaps representing certain sets of members, chairing committees, coordinating volunteer organizers. If the board includes members of your opposition, the process is more difficult, requiring caucusing and appraisals of how the opposition will vote on each item. Still, your allies on the board are key to the leadership team. A broad leadership network. This is the officers, business agents, stewards, and rank and file activists who support the reform program and work together in the union structures to translate it into action. The broadly defined leadership for the local. This group will likely form the core leadership of the rejuvenated Stewards Council, for example. Many, but not all, will belong to your reform caucus, see below, which in turn will be a source of new leaders. It's important not to limit the network just to those who campaigned for you or belonged to the reform group all along. Rather, it needs to co-opt former neutrals and those newly energized by the reforms you're undertaking. By going beyond the officials to include rank and filers, the network will be able to get reliable feedback from the members and mobilize one-on-one. Reform Caucus. The temptation is to allow the rank-and-file-based Reform Caucus that was the backbone of your campaign to dissolve now that you've won. Now that you are in charge of the union, what do you need it for? You're going to make the union itself open to the rank-and-file. Actually, you need an independent reform caucus now more than ever. The battle to change the union locally and perhaps nationally has moved ahead a step, but there is still much to be done. The hard task will still be dismantling the institutions and attitudes of business unionism that are embedded in the union. The Reform Caucus, of course, should function independently of the union, not using union resources in any way, not allowed to all caucuses. See section entitled Reformers, Do You Need an Independent Caucus After Winning Office for more on this subject. Mobilizing coordinator. Delegate a key officer or staff member to be the mobilizing coordinator. Someone who thinks of new ways to get members plugged in, stays on top of all the volunteer activities and which ones need a hand, and reminds leaders of their responsibility to recruit new activists. Remember that getting members involved is every leader's job. The coordinator is there to keep an eye on how it's going, not to be the sole member of the mobilizing department. Advisors. Never assume that anything is a purely technical question that can be left to someone simply because he or she is an expert. All advisors come with their own outlook and agenda. Just keep Ron's Kerry's experience with his campaign consultants in mind. They backed his candidacy but were schooled in the ways of big party politics, so that making a buck off illegal contributions was part of the game. Be sure that your advisors understand and share the reform perspective. Avoid consultants whose expertise is working with business or traditional business unions. They will bring the wrong lessons. Administering a local based on democracy and membership involvement is not the same as administering a business or a business based on top-down control. For the same reasons, be careful with business self-help books. These may include some helpful advice, but remember they are based on other assumptions and goals. An advisor is only good as her understanding of what your situation is. If you wait until a crisis or an immediate decision is required, then you've already lost important opportunities for choice, and the advisor will be ill-prepared. Pick your advisors early, give them the necessary background material, and keep them up to date and accountable. Here are some types of advisors or consultants you may want. Please note that these are not necessarily hired consultants or paid staffers. The first place to look is in your own membership. It's likely you'll find a computer or desktop publishing specialist and often other surprising talents, maybe cartoonist or someone who knows bookkeeping. Be sure to get them training as needed. So here's the list. Successful reform officers in other locals. A contact person in the reform movement in your union's industry, if any. A communications specialist. A person who knows his or her way around the international. A lawyer. Contract specialist for key contracts. A facilitator for your strategic planning meetings. See below. A union office administrator. Someone experienced with running meetings and parliamentary procedure. An accountant. A computer internet specialist. A desktop publishing person. Your local may already have a lawyer on contract. Don't wait until you can change that arrangement. One way or the other, find a lawyer who has some experience with rank and file unionism and whom you can trust. Lawyers are for legal advice. Unless they have otherwise established themselves, beware of their political and organizational advice. Delegate. The critical word here is teamwork. The leadership skills you need to learn quickly are delegation and encouraging feedback. Unless you are in a very small local, don't try to be everyone's steward. When you talk to members on the phone or visit them, listen, take notes, ask questions, hear them out, but tell the member you will see that the concern will be looked into and assign the task to the appropriate person. Make sure she gets back with that member. Don't get sucked into personal involvement with every investigation. If you fail to delegate, you will soon lose your health, spouse, staff, and next election. Probably in that order. Members know you aren't superhuman, so don't try to act that way. Respect and trust your fellow leaders. It's your responsibility to see that things get done, but it's not your job to do them personally. Hold a planning meeting. Ideally, you will have begun planning for your reform administration well before you're elected, but assuming that most of your energy has gone into the election and there's still much to do, take advantage of the lame duck period to call a broad planning meeting. Now is not the time for a rest, even if you deserve one from an exhausting campaign. Planning here serves two purposes. First, failing to plan means planning to fail. Second, the planning process itself is a good way to put your broad leadership and reform forces on the same page. One of the important differences between top-down union organization and democratic unionism is that top-down depends on people doing what they are told. While there is still hierarchy in a democratic union structure, we try to depend on people taking initiative and making many decisions on their own because they have the same goals. The way unity of goals is achieved is through joint discussion, planning, feedback, and evaluation. Have your strategic planning meeting somewhere you can be uninterrupted. If you can make it 2 or 3 days, the time is well spent. If you have not done strategic planning before, get some assistance. You might find help at a college labor studies department. Again, this is not simply a technical job. Make sure the advisor you get has the experience with rank and file unionism. For more discussion, get of strategic planning, see Labor Notes, A Troublemaker's Handbook. At this meeting, identify your situation, both internal and external. External, what are you facing from the employers? Remember, this is primarily why the members elected you. Internal, does the steward system work? Which committees really function? Do you need new technology to track grievances? New staff, who are your supporters in the local? Who is on the fence? Who can be won over? Is there an old guard already mobilizing to bring you down? Set long-term goals and your strategy for reaching them. These will determine your plans for building support, making appointments, choosing priorities, and even how you run your meetings. Determine priorities. Example, rebuild the steward system, begin contract campaigns, set organizing targets in that order. Remember that you must start some visible campaigns and changes immediately. Also remember that priorities may change as you take office and start hearing more from members about what they want done. Make crucial immediate decisions. Brainstorm lists of tasks. Look at the sample lists at the end of this chapter. Divide them into ones you start now, ones that you must wait until you take office. Turn them into assignment sheets. Here is a great opportunity to establish the model of delegating responsibility. The list would be overwhelming for one person. But if you developed a leadership team leading up to and in the course of your election campaign, you can divide them up and attack them successfully. As you can see, our list of sample tasks are long and the items range from big policy type issues to such as priority campaigns to detailed administrative questions. When you brainstorm, your list will come out in no particular order. It's worth spending a little time to group similar tasks, but the main thing is to identify the priorities and get those, if not all the tasks, assigned to people, clear on what they're supposed to accomplish, by when, and to whom they must report back. It's a good idea to have this kind of meeting on a regular basis. The longer ones usually work best if they're facilitated by someone outside the local, but who works with the local so they understand the issues. Reform leaders in some locals have yearly meetings like this and shorter quarterly meetings to keep up to date. Plan these ahead and put them on your calendar in ink. If at all possible, newly elected officers should find a way to get released from work to address these tasks. In a democratic union, the old leadership would cooperate with by insisting that the employers release you. But your predecessors may prefer to make your job difficult. If necessary, use vacation time or some other method. This is a critical period, and the time invested now will pay off later. Rebuild the union around the membership. This is your highest priority. There is no single way to do it. In some cases, it will require new bodies or programs. In other cases, a radically different approach to the old ones. Looking for and encouraging new activists and leaders should be a daily concern of all officers and reps. Don't wait. Ask members to be involved even before you take office. Start a newsletter immediately. This will be one of your main devices for communicating with the membership. Get assistance from someone with experience outside the local, if necessary, so you can train your people to do it well. Fix the steward system. The stewards are the critical link between the members at the worksite and the union as an organization. If your bylaws call for appointed stewards, make sure that you have good stewards in place. Then start working on alternate stewards. Then plan to move to get an elected steward system. As a temporary measure, you can always agree to appoint the stewards that members select in an unofficial election. Encourage the good stewards and find replacements for the bad ones. Set up an intensive training program for stewards. Even experienced stewards will need this, since you are projecting different procedures for the union and a different role for the stewards as the organizers of members' involvement. As you recruit good stewards, build a steward council. One of your top leaders should sit down with each steward so that you discover their strengths and weaknesses and develop a training plan for each. Devise a plan for doing this with each new replacement in the future. Give the stewards useful tools. See that each one gets a copy of The Legal Rights of Union Stewards by Robert Schwartz. Get a bulk subscription to Labor Notes to give stewards a sense of being part of a broader reform movement, as well as useful nuts and bolts on tips on organizing. Here's a box with a stewards survey. This survey will help new union officers get to know stewards' strengths, weaknesses, and interests. It is ideally done one-on-one between a top leader and the steward. Name, phone numbers, home, can you be reached by phone, at work, what number, family members, steward experience in other unions, ever held union office, have you ever worked on a newsletter, writing or editing, production, do you have a computer, programs you know, what special skills do you have that can be used to build a union? Examples, songwriting, drawing, graphic design, acting, sports organizing, silk screening t-shirts. What community and or religious organizations are you a member of? Would you be willing to serve as a union liaison to this organization? Could you make a map of the members in your district? Explain mapping the workplace. What parts of the contract do you feel you know what best, and what parts of the contract do you want more assistance or training? What do you like best about being a steward? What do you like least? Are there any union committees in which you would like to be active? Which list the committees are available. List which committees are available. are there new committees you think we should form, and what would you like to be part of? Are there skills you would like more training in? For example, speaking, writing grievances, writing articles, note-taking, computer. Here are some of the training programs available to the local union. Note that most require you to use your own time. In some, the local union can help defray part of the cost, but our resources are limited. Which look most interesting or useful to you, and list local training programs. Make the union's committees functional. Committees might include a newsletter committee, organizing committee, civil rights committee, community relations committee, and others. Committees should reflect the union's priorities. If legislation on bargaining rights is key, for example, you'll need an active committee to coordinate pressure on legislators. Post descriptions of the committees and invite volunteers. Don't promise that all volunteers will be on the committee. Discuss the committee's work at one or more union meetings. Appoint people you can count on to chair the committees. Recruit potential leaders you and the reps have identified. Carefully build a committee so that they can succeed. This may mean excluding some old guard members. Give the committees the resources, independence, and flexibility they need, and let them go. If they don't go, find out why, appoint new people. There's a box called Tools for Stewards. Labor Notes, an independent monthly newsletter by and for activists who are putting the movement back in the labor movement. A monthly bulk order costs 35 cents per copy, minimum 5 copies, plus shipping to order CPAC cover. Labor Party Press. Well, this no longer exists. The Legal Rights of Union Stewards by Robert M. Schwartz, available from Labor Notes. Labor Notes books. For example, Stopping Sexual Harassment, A Troublemaker's Handbook, Working Smart, and I would add Secrets of a Successful Organizer, among others. The Stewards Toolkit, all available at labornotes.org. Get member mobilization campaigns going. A contract campaign, a major grievance issue, a battle against a cooperation program, a political or lobbying initiative. Any of these may be good places to start. To decide, you might begin with a membership survey to supplant the one you already know through your campaign work. A survey is a great signal to the rank and file that something different is going on. Notice, if you ask members what they want, you'll have to plan to take seriously what they propose. The worst thing you can do is ask people what they want with no plan to follow through. The membership surveys and your strategic planning meetings should have identified priority campaigns for the union. Get them moving and get the members involved in all phases of decision making and control. See the box for an example of a campaign that tapped members' creativity. Okay, here's the box. A member mobilization campaign to fight team concept. The remarkable rank and file unity and involvement that won the 1997 Teamsters strike against UPS was foreshadowed by an earlier union campaign. The International Union initiated a campaign against a management program called Team Concept, and the organizing was also pushed from below by TDU. In the Postal Service, it was called Employee Involvement. In some locals, old guard leaders had endorsed Team Concept and allowed UPS to do whatever it wanted in this area. The International's Education Department developed a series of materials, including a 15-minute video on the UPS team programs, and held regional workshops for business agents, stewards, and rank and filers on members' rights in the programs and tactics for dealing with them. Our campaign focused on trust, said John Braxton, a TDU leader and Education Department staffer. Management kept saying that we would work better with trust, and we kept pointing out that actions speak louder than words. The union pushed the issues, the management's record on these, instead of debating team concept abstractly, The battle took different shapes in different locals. Here are examples of how rank and filers, or local leaders, took the ball and ran with it. At the Madison Heights, Michigan UPS Center, management made the team meetings compulsory. Activists used the meetings to shift their own agenda to their own agenda. When the company would try to get us to talk about costs, we talked about the cost of living and wages for part-timers. When they would talk about productivity, we would discuss health and safety, explains Dave Steger, a TDU activist. The company appointed team leaders for package sorting lines. Under union pressure, the job was changed to a seniority bid. A few people saw this job as a stepping stone to management, but others took it because they wanted it to be held by a pro-union person. Management hoped these team leaders would be the scab leaders for the upcoming contract, Tager says. But during the pre-strike contract campaign, we asked many team leaders to be the contract campaign coordinators, which made sense since they were often the natural leaders of the work groups. These team leaders actively promoted the contract campaign and were solid during the strike. Afterward, the company abolished the team leader positions. At the UPS Center outside Modesto, California, a union member got up and declared himself team leader for life, and all the other team leaders bowed down to him. In 6 weeks, management threw in the towel and declared the program over. At the Redmond, Washington Center, UPS kept bringing up ideas in their clean sheet meetings. There were clearly bargaining issues: incentive pay, worker involvement in screening new hires, Teamsters auditing fellow Teamsters for mistakes. The company blitzed us with meetings, weekly and sometimes twice weekly, said steward John Mashish. Mashish filed a grievance when the company refused to pay him as a steward to attend every team meeting it called, since contractual issues were always discussed. Members circulated a petition to back the grievance, saying they wanted union representation at these meetings. One member worked very hard to design a new delivery route, believing that this would remove some of the work overload. But when the company used the route without posting it for bidding, it was clear that management cared only for its own flexibility and not about reducing workloads. It took a union grievance to force the route to go to bid. After 6 months, attendance at the voluntary meetings dropped to a trickle, and that mainly for the easy overtime pay. In San Antonio, steward Nancy Crittenden says that the meetings started out quite pleasantly, an hour of overtime and free breakfast. But we tried to get the company to use first line tires on the trucks for safety, and the company used the meetings to show us propaganda films about retreads. Her local supplemented the international's education materials with its own Brown Dog News. The union materials and company actions got us all to understand that we had to act together, and people stopped going, says Crittenden. In Cleveland, clerks collectively decided to ignore a job posting for a higher paid team leader position. Activists in Iowa used a petition campaign to end the program. In Milwaukee, members wore T-shirts that said, "I'm already on a team, the Teamsters." Nancy Crittenden says that besides getting rid of team concept, the campaign served the purpose of strengthening the union for the bigger battle ahead. No one in our center had ever experienced a strike. We teamed together to get rid of our team concept, and the strike really brought us together as a team for the union. And that's that box on mobilization campaign to fight the team concept. Okay. Get member mobilization campaigns going. Begin external organizing. Organizing new members depends on getting current members involved in the campaign. but you are advised to get help from experienced organizers. Set up an organizing drive. Setting up an organizing drive is a difficult task. Good training for volunteers and our staff helps a lot. Organizing also requires a substantial budget. You want to make sure the resources are used effectively. You might target suppliers to your employer, non-union units within your workplace, or if you are in a right-to-work state, the non-members within your bargaining unit. Take the union to the members. Since most members will not attend the general membership meeting, take the union to the members. Think about meetings by shift, department, or job classification at times and locations that members can attend. Serve food. Have meetings in the parking lot or break rooms if possible. Put the members themselves in charge of arrangements. If the union covers a wide geographical area, consider moving union meetings to different locations. Make worksite visits your top priority. You know the common complaint. We never see anyone from the union office unless there's an election. It's very easy to get chained to your desk, buried with the details of administrative projects like the new computer or voice messaging system. It's easy to get swamped following through on grievance appeals. But there's a little secret you should know. No matter how much time you spend at the office, there's no way you can take care of all the stuff that comes in. By making worksite visits take precedence, you send a message that your priority is one-on-one organizing and that other officers and activists are expected to follow suit. Make a schedule for visiting sites. Set a time and don't be late. When you arrive, don't visit the boss first. Always call key union activists to let them know you're coming and visit with them first. Sometimes hold cookouts in the parking lot and or have a cooler of cold drinks for the members after work. There is nothing like breaking bread or sharing a cold one with members to help you keep in touch. It's job number one. Get your whole leadership out in the field in contact with the members. Make sure someone covers company picnics, sports, and social and family events. The budget. Here's a box on the budget. Whatever flowery promises are made in election leaflets, the real priorities are revealed in the local union's budget. If training stewards is a top priority, you will be able to tell it from the funds allocated. A union that says organizing is job one, but devotes 1% of its funds to recruiting is not serious. If you're not versed in principles of accounting or the details of budgeting, then you must get assistance, because the budget will reflect your most important policy decisions. Creating a budget forces you to plan, lets people in charge of certain areas know what resources they can expect, helps prevent overextension in plans and promises, provides a system of monitoring and control, and provides an overview of priorities. Your primary income is dues. Dues income will be increased by new organizing, but not without making a significant investment first. A priority you place on new organizing should not be based on expecting an immediate cash flow advantage, but in power considerations. How will organizing this shop strengthen our local and the labor movement in general? You can raise money for specific projects through the sale of t-shirts, hats, buttons, or advertising in the local newspaper. Even for a popular Reform Administration, special assessments will be hard to get through unless the case for the specific need is very clear and strong. Although certain expenditures are usually treated as fixed, per capita dues to the international mortgage payments on the Union Hall, for example, take a look at them anyway. It may be the international will rebate part of the per caps for special organizing projects. The hall may be your most expensive asset, and it could be more valuable if sold and the money used to benefit the members. Selling the hall is not a move to take lightly or quickly, but it might make sense if the demographics of the local or the workplaces represented have changed since the hall was first established. The hall may have a fair amount of surplus funds stashed. Oh, the union may have a fair amount of surplus funds stashed away. Having some cushion to help balance out income expenditures during difficult periods is desirable, but beyond that, there's no point to showing you can accumulate big savings. Use it for strengthening the union. Use it for organizing new members. Build mobilization and involvement into the budget. More leaflets, newsletters, meetings, places close to work locations, all these cost something. If you want rank and file assistant stewards, you will have to budget for training. Fight the notion that any time someone does something for the union, they should be paid for lost time. But you have to also be prepared to partially compensate people who give up lots of work time to take on key union responsibilities. Publicize your plans and changes. Publicizing what's new and moving helps to change members' expectations and helps them hold your feet to the fire. Check pay and perks. Nothing contributes more to bureaucratization and breaking the link between workers and members than significant pay and lifestyle differences. Some locals have a policy of equal pay for all full-time staff based on the pay of members in the largest unit in the local. Union-leased cars are very visible. They should be utilitarian, not luxurious. Have a realistic expense policy so the people who spend their time doing union business do not find themselves in debt. Become familiar with procedures of your international. Every international provides resources for local leaders. Some of it is essential nuts and bolts that you need to get down pat. This includes dues payments, procedures for grievance handling, and various international union reporting procedures. If you don't get them right, things can grind to a halt, or worse, embroil you in time-consuming technical and legal difficulties. The trick in many internationals is to separate out the kernels that you need from all the junk that stems from a business union approach. That's where advice from other reformers in local office can be valuable. Review administrative procedures. The philosophy of the union is embedded in how it carries out day-to-day activities. Are the union officers accessible, or do members who call get ignored, brushed off, or sent on wild goose chases? Do the officers and staff act like the union belongs to them or to the members? Like it or not, you must pay attention to administrative procedures. Always ask, what is the flow? What do members see? Draw flow charts for handling a grievance, how a member's question is handled, what happens when a member volunteers for a union activity, what happens when a member reports some unusual employer activity, new or leased equipment, large transactions with the previously unknown company. Then check and revise policies on use of resources. What are the guidelines on reimbursements to members or staff? Who can rent the meeting hall? When? Check particularly policies on the use of credit cards and expense allowances. The tone you must set is that the resources of the local belong to the members and cannot be wasted by anyone, least of all officers or staff. At the same time, all union services and facilities must be available to the members on an open and as fair a basis as possible. Administrative policy should be written and available to all members so they understand what the standard is and help hold staff to that standard. Regular, well-planned staff meetings are a must. This is your opportunity to gather information and give clear direction and evaluation. Write a meeting agenda and distribute it in advance after encouraging staff members to bring up suggestions for it. In between meetings, communicate with your staff regularly. Administrative policies. Here's a box. Some items you'll need to cover to create both the appearance and the reality of fairness and keep things running smoothly. And these the subheads are staff rules, grievance handling and organizing staff, members, and general administrative policies. Okay, staff rules. Vacation scheduling, sick days, holidays, funeral leave. Comp time, work schedule, office hours. Reimbursement of expenses, car expenses. Meals and meetings. Per diem, out-of-town expenses. Frequent flyer miles. Pay period. Christmas bonus. Telephone etiquette. Phone log policy. Proper use of voicemail. Answering pages. Filing and retrieval. Shipping and mailing. Office security. Inventory control. Personal use of cell phones, union vehicles, credit cards. Personal use of copiers, computers, internet. Smoking in the office. Dress code. Okay, those are staff rules to cover to create the appearance and reality of fairness. Grievance handling and organizing staff. Grievance processing rules. Grievance log. Shop visits. Access to confidential records. Union reps daily activity log. Union rep conduct. Services to members versus non-members. Returning calls. Operating in another union rep's area of responsibility. Members. Solidarity fund for fired members. Member travel to grievance hearings and arbitration. Lost time wages. Use of toll-free numbers. Special occasion gifts. Member sickness or health or death. Use of hall by members. General. Sexual harassment policy. Responsibility for communications with other groups in the community. Accounting for sales of union merchandise and materials, jackets, t-shirts, books. Decision making on kind and amount of strike assistance for other unions. Appointments. Depending on your local's structure, you may have to appoint business agents or stewards, pick benefit specialists, even hire clerical and janitorial staff. If you have committee job, you may have committee jobs to fill, and you'll have informal appointments too, people who will serve as your resources, spokespersons, or agents on various issues. Technology, education, certain departments or locations. Don't underestimate the importance of any of these jobs, and don't underestimate the fact that those doing these jobs when you took over were people trained by and probably loyal to the officers you replaced. While some may be quite competent, honest, and grateful to finally have some more aggressive or more above board administration, others may still think of themselves as agents for the old guard and actively try to get back to the good old days. After all, your reform means that the union is going to work a lot harder for the members, and that's going to mean more work for the staff. Look for two criteria to make when making appointments: loyalty to the program of reform and competence on the job. Note that competence can be learned. Don't confuse loyalty with ass kissing. You want people who will tell you the truth as they see it. You want people who can think and act independently, but they have to be in basic support of the program. The most competent organizer is of little use if he's trying to undermine members' control of the union. Try to make your appointees look like your membership. Pay special attention to ensure that minorities, women, and others who have been treated as second-class citizens in your local are well represented. Appointments are also a way of sealing arrangements of mutual support with various groupings within the union. You want to reach out as far as possible, but not so far that you fall over. That is, you don't do yourself any favor by bringing in people who will later embarrass you or work to undermine you or the reform program. You may have to fire a staffer or de-appoint a committee member and train someone new. This is preferable to having someone in the office that you don't trust to carry out the members reform program. Of course, you need to respect any contractual obligations that may exist. Some locals hire outside contractors to take over responsibilities like putting out the local newspaper, public relations, or even bargaining. These arrangements are usually part of the mainstays of business unionism. Plan to bring these jobs back to the members. They are crucial skills for developing new leaders. Even if a member requires a little more technical training, she understands the problems of the job better than a professional consultant and will better understand and communicate with the membership. If you need to bring in outsiders, make it a limited number for a limited duration, with training your people at the top of their priorities. Look for opportunities to spread appointments out. For example, within a budget, it may be possible to have several rank-and-file assistant business agents instead of one full-time business agent. One of your biggest problems will be appointments in joint labor management programs. You may have dozens of these jobs negotiated by the international or the previous leadership. They may include quality, attendance, training, employee assistance, and health and safety. All too often, union appointees to these positions end up sounding and acting like management. You need to have a long-range plan for how the union will operate in these programs, up to and including dismantling the injurious ones. In the meantime, you need to have people in them whom you can trust to tell you what's going on and carry out a pro-union course. For more information, see Labor Notes, Working Smart. Dealing with the old opposition. After a tough and grueling election campaign, one of the hardest things to do is to maintain the campaigning spirit while shifting the definition of who is the opposition. During elections, candidates will make some pretty vicious attacks, many of them personal. It can be very easy for your supporters to view an election victory as a license for payback. Screw those who didn't support you. On the other hand, sentiment among a large portion of the membership will be to put all past history aside, end the politics, and get on with the job of running the union. Both may be big mistakes. One of your first tasks in the planning process is to evaluate the forces in your local and determine an appropriate strategy for each. We can't stress too much that this cannot be seen in terms of a leadership-to-leadership discussion and arrangement between new officers and the outgoing slate. That what counts is the long-term effect your relationship with the opposition will have on members, their participation in the union, or their cynicism about it. What led Dodd, a leader in the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, says about dealing with management also applies to talking with personal opponents within the union. Don't say anything in a private conversation that you wouldn't say in front of a membership meeting. You want to be as inclusive as possible while maintaining commitment to the program you were elected on. As much as possible, you want to make it possible for former opponents or fence sitters to sign up with your side and the reform program without having to grovel. In fact, you may want to make immediate overtures to some of the forces and possibly offer them positions in your leadership structure. You'll want to include people who have a needed skill or knowledge, or who have a base among some group of members if they're likely to buy into the new program. It's a tough balancing act because you run the risk of loyal supporters getting angry if they are passed over for what seems to be a reward to someone on the other side. It means your leaders and activists have to have common agreement that the issue is not to the victors go the spoils, but rather creating the strongest possible leadership for the battles to come. Be careful. Bringing in former opposition leaders may weaken your ability to turn the union around. They may not be in agreement with enough of your program or be more concerned with building their own following so that the net result is immobilization. Some of the people you defeated were not bad people. They may have been burned out, or they just believed in the traditional business unionism. If they don't want to come over to your side and help, allow them the option of fading away gracefully. There's no value in rubbing their noses in defeat and mobilizing them into opposition. It's likely some opponents will choose not to join you based not so much on policy differences as on historic factors. Different departments, different cultural groups, different job classifications, and so on. Normally, you should gracefully accept their self-definition as independent from your forces and attempt to work with them on specific items of agreement. A special case is the opposition we call the old guard, the group of former leaders who are so invested in being the leadership that their own only concern is discrediting you so they can get back into office. It would be nice if the old guard would just fold their tents and go away after the election, but it's not likely to happen. First, they have the democratic right to criticize you and prepare for the next election. And although democracy and the membership may be the furthest thing from their concern, they will get the benefit of legitimate member support for the ideas, for the idea of honest opposition. Second, since your election means an end to sweetheart deals with the company, the old guard is going to find plenty of management support. In the lead up to the 1997 UPS contract bargaining, for example, management was caught on tape conspiring with an old guard official to undermine the union negotiating committee. An old guard opposition group in your local may also get encouragement, advice, or financial support from officials of other locals and perhaps the international who want to prevent the spread of a rank-and-file movement for reform. Dealing with the old guard after you take office can be tricky. You don't want anything that you do in response to them to intimidate members or discourage member discussion. Constant battles at membership meetings can turn off members who want to be involved. Trading charges of corruption will just convince many people that union activity is a waste. You have to make the tactical decisions when to fight them and when to ignore them. You also need to be prepared for charges of undemocratic if you stop the old guard from dominating discussion at union meetings, or if you deny them their favorite trips or other perks. They may try to set up situations so that you look bad in front of membership. You have to take all this into account, but keep focused on the long run. You have to be firm and move on, ruling people out of order if need be, even if some members who don't know the whole story or situation feel that you're being heavy-handed. In the long run, the truth will be evident, but you cannot allow them to tie up the union while this happens. Here are a few tips on dealing with the old guard. Be clear on your democratic obligations. Your obligations are to the membership and to carry out their program. The former officers have all the rights of members, but no special rights just because they were former officers. They do not have the right to special dealing with management or special treatment by the union. You have limited resources, such as a small budget, to send members for training. Be sure to use it for members who are developing into new leaders and not to quiet old guard complainers. Keep the spirit of the election alive. It was the election issues that motivated the members. Try to stick to those issues, not personalities. If you work on the issues, it will remind people why they repudiated the old guard. Let the old guard expose themselves for being cranks and having no program. Figure out their base of support and work to take it away. Do clean surgical strikes. When you do fight them directly, be prepared to do a quick but thorough job. If the issue is finance, from your audit of the books and records, do a short report to the membership. Make sure the report gets wide distribution. Have copies when you visit worksites, and especially have it ready for your first general membership meeting. thoroughly explain the corruption and make clear that you will not tolerate it. For example, if they wrote union checks to local liquor stores, adult nightclubs, or similar establishments, take the canceled checks down to the local coffee shop, blow them up to poster size, and have them on display for the first meeting. Be prepared for membership meetings. Do everything you can to get your people there. If the old guard is active, make sure that your people have prepared in advance and understand the issues and have floor leaders assigned to handle each. Consider serving food or at least coffee, juice, and snacks prior to the meeting. Hold a rally in the parking lot prior to your first meeting after you take office. Have plans to handle disruption. Remember in all this that your goal for membership meetings is to facilitate members carrying on the union's work, not debate the old guard. Reformers, do you need an independent reform caucus after winning office? Much of this chapter has been aimed at giving an emphatic yes to that question. Keeping a caucus organized in support of reform leaders' program is often necessary to the program's success and to leaders' political survival. The caucus provides votes on policy where needed and trained troops to carry out some of the necessary volunteer work. This support is key even where local opposition is weak. As reformers in the Teamsters, UAW, and UFCW have found, old guard officials of the parent union may work hard to undermine local reform leaders. We can imagine a union where a reform caucus becomes irrelevant, where there's overall agreement on the union's direction and a strong culture of members deciding that direction, where members freely organize around short-term issues such as for and against some contract proposal or political endorsement, but you won't be there when you first win office. Keeping a reform caucus active after winning an election has been difficult in most places. Partly that's because many people believe that good union leadership does indeed make the caucus unnecessary. Its role is certainly a lot less clear. Partly the difficulty is maintaining a truly independent caucus when the main leaders have now become officers. The tendency is for some of the caucus to operate solely as support for those officers and other caucus members to lose interest. Here's a box. Balancing the pressures. One of the founders, Victor Reuther, one of the founders of the United Auto Workers, addressed the TDU convention in 1992 after Ron Kerry first won election. On members' minds was whether they still needed TDU now that a reformer had won the presidency. Holding one hand in the air, Reuther used the other to apply pressure till it bent over. That was the pressure of the employers, the government, the business union traditions, and the day-to-day problems. Rod Carey depends on the members to keep putting pressure on the other side. That is why we need TDU to continue and grow. How right Reuther was. Keeping an independent caucus is important if difficult. For one thing, no one is perfect. While we don't suggest that the reader would ever be tempted to take a kickback or stray from the members' priorities, union officers face many gray areas. Good people can differ on what's proper. An independent caucus keeps officers on track with what the members approve of or don't. Also, we may as well admit that there are plenty of examples of good people going bad. You and other officers are subject to huge pressures, including overwork, management attempts to compromise you, and corrupt influences. An independent caucus helps maintain an anchor point in the rank and file and in the principles of reform. You may also need to wage an ongoing fight against the old guard in your local. The employers in the old guard may have too many interests at stake to allow you to act unchallenged. As officers of the local, you have to carefully represent everybody. But an active rank-and-file group can both defend you and expand the reform movement in areas in the local where reform is weak or where there are poor representatives. By its independence, a caucus can maintain closer ties to the ranks. That may be necessary for the caucus to maintain its credibility Ours is a cynical society, and we're too used to thinking of politics as about individuals and not ideas. If the caucus has an independent life, its own meetings and newsletter, it helps show that it's about certain ideas, not just keeping its allies in office. A caucus's independent life will also provides additional opportunities for leadership training. Rank and filers taking responsibility for everything from caucus newsletter content to planning meetings and learning the basics of organizing as they do. More important, the caucus will be a place for gloves-off discussion of union politics, why certain people promote certain policies and what's good and bad about their stance. Caucus meetings can help rank and filers sort out the debates going on in the local, where they stand and why. The same kind of discussion may be needed about national or international union policies and elections. And again, local officers may feel constrained to be diplomatic in their criticisms of higher officials, while rank and file caucus leaders can be more blunt. Caucus activities will change in the new situation. Remember that much of your past work was the education and organizing that the union should have been doing and will start doing now because of its new leadership. But the new leaders will have difficulties and make mistakes. The caucus will still need to fill in on the union's work where, for example, an old guard supporter gets elected steward or officers make an appointment that doesn't work out. Within the local, an independent caucus can take the lead, discussing initiating local action and policies. They may propose bylaws changes that would help reform processes or formulate contract demands to present to a demands meeting. This would normally be in communication with local leaders, but on the caucus's initiative. Thus, the leadership load is shared and democracy is strengthened. Finally, union reform has to spread beyond the local, or it cannot survive. One goal of the caucus should be to help members of other locals push their leaders in a reform direction, or elect new ones. Many contracts, grievances, and decisions about jurisdiction are settled at higher levels of the union. Reform needs to spread beyond your union and throughout the labor movement. A new reform-minded leadership may be working hard to build the kind of local union where issues are so constructively debated and members so actively involved that an independent rank-and-file caucus is redundant. But that's a very difficult goal. Experience shows an ongoing reform caucus is needed to get there. New officers checklist. Immediately after winning an election, you need to plan and assign a wide range of tasks. Many can be started during the lame duck period. Others can be planned now and implemented after you take office. How much you can accomplish during the lame duck period depends partly on how cooperative the outgoing officers are. Following is a list of tasks gathered from several local unions. They are not necessarily in the same chronological or priority order or even the same tasks, but that would fit your situation, but they should be a helpful guide. Many of these tasks can and should be done before you are sworn in. Following the list of tasks is an assignment sheet you can use to ensure follow through. 1. Report back to the members right away. Distribute a post-election leaflet. Set up a web page, email, or newsletter communication to activists. 2. Arrange leaves of absence. Request a leave from your employer for the length of transition period and term of office, asking current officers to intervene if necessary and using applicable contract language. 3. Hold a strategic planning meeting. Arrange for uninterrupted time with your broad leadership team to look at the big picture. 4. Audit the books. Have an independent, union-friendly CPA check out the books and prepare a report suitable for publication to the members. Do it right away so you can make a presentation at your first membership meeting. Use handouts and big charts to clearly establish the record and baseline of your administration. Send out an abbreviated report to the members to show how you plan to change things. Ask the accountant to locate all funds and all accounts. 5. Secure office space in the hall. Your presence at the union hall is important during the transition. Learn what you can and keep your eyes open. 6. Plan first issue of union newspaper. If the local does not already have one, start one. Have the articles written so you can get it out during the first 2 weeks of your new administration. Be sure to include articles by and interviews with rank-and-file members. By what is said and how it looks, your newsletter must signal the priorities of your administration. 7. Determine the status of all current negotiations, strikes, organizing drives. Develop a plan to maintain continuity or to make big changes. 8. Determine and plan your immediate priority campaigns. Is the first priority a contract campaign, an organizing drive, a program to reactivate the union in some areas? Whatever it is, a campaign that involves members is critical to bringing the union together. 9. Fill in your map of the local. This is the map you probably use during your campaign. Complete information on the number of members, the stewards, the names of your key supporters at each work site. 10. Make plans to strengthen the steward system. Begin using the steward survey and look toward a steward newsletter and steward's council. 11. Know where to get help. Draw up your list of experts and consultants. Become familiar with the support services available from the internationals. Schedule a visit to other reform locals. Arrange for an experienced reform officer to meet with your leadership and answer nuts and bolts questions. 12. Take inventory. Have a written inventory of all supplies, equipment, etc. Review the report with your trustees. Your international probably has required procedures for inventory. 13. Make arrangements to change locks, passwords, and signatures on accounts. Send written notification to the outgoing officers and staff to turn in all records and equipment belonging to the local. 14. Write a preliminary budget. Review the past administration's spending over the past 3 years, how they spent members' money was their mission statement. The same will be true for you. Remember this as you set your policies, make your plans first, and then make out your budget. 15. Guard the hall. You and some of your most trusted supporters may need to discourage theft and vandalism before you take office. As a last resort, post a guard in the parking lot. Notify the police of what you're doing. 17. Prepare new business cards and a letterhead. Have it at your union printer ready to go on day one. 18. Contact the staff. Determine who does what jobs and what problems they have. Find out their ideas on improvements. Familiarize yourself with all contacts and personnel policies. Prepare to make changes as necessary. 18. Line up additional temporary help. You may need help in the office with contract negotiations or handling grievances. Bring in the help to deal with any backlog of work. 19. Review all standing committees. Review their function and who's on them. If they are appointed, replace leaders as necessary. 20. Review bylaws, constitution, and meeting rules. Go over key ones with your leadership. You may even want to practice chairing in anticipation of your first membership meeting. 21. Look over past records of meetings. You will need to know about past decisions and policies for running the local. Ask the outgoing officers for cooperation. Make a list of all policies and actions that need to be continued or modified when you come into office. Make this part of your first executive board meeting. 22. Review all contracts. Study all contracts administered by the local. Note all expiration dates. Make a chart. Familiarize yourself with the grievance procedure in each. 23. Know the employers. Start a working file on management personnel with whom you are likely to be dealing. Note both personal and professional information. 24. Contact all benefit plans and trusts. Let them know you will be taking office. Ask for the training if you have any trustee responsibilities. Contact the heads of state or regional bodies of your international. Write a letter to introduce yourself and ask for the relevant bylaws and schedule of meetings. Introduce yourself to the AFL-CIO, Central Labor Council, or leaders of other unions with whom you expect to start working. review all contracts for services. Make changes where necessary. in maintenance agreements, supply agreements, cleaning contracts, etc. Contact the Retirees Club. Familiarize yourself with the club's officers and activities. Retirees are often a great source of experience and help for organizing and for political and contract support. Plan for modernization. Computers, voicemail, pagers, cell phones. Make the new technologies work for you. Audit all subscriptions. Cancel inappropriate ones and order the ones that will help your staff and members. And then the next page is an assignment sheet, which has a chart that goes has from left to right. Task, assign to, report to, date for first report, date for completion, and notes. Assignment sheet. Hint, you can list several types of jobs in the task column. Include overall coordinator type jobs dealing with the big assignments, like plan strategic planning meeting, as well as specific tasks that fall under the bigger jobs. Arrange meeting space for strategic planning meeting or standalone. Order monthly bundle of labor notes. And in either case, be as specific as possible. Write down interview stewards using steward survey and evaluate grievance tracking system. Not rebuild steward system. Don't forget to delegate. The report to item may be either an individual or a body, such as an executive board. The rest of the book is structures and bylaws, international conventions, and elections. I am not going to read those. They're even more detailed than the last chapter. If you want to get to those structures and bylaws, international conventions and international elections, buy the book Democracy is Power, available for $10 from Labor Notes at labornotes.org. And there's also another couple appendixes that I did not mention, although in chapter 4 I did read appendix 1, being effective at union meetings, and appendix 2, leading a membership meeting. But there's an appendix 3 called Hints on Using Robert's Rules of Order, and appendix 4, Simplified Rules of Order, neither of which I'm going to read, and appendix 5, which is suggested bylaws, and appendix 6, which is resources such as the Association for Union Democracy, etc. So that wraps it up. Hope to see you at our book study July 11th. Register at bit.ly/3SundaysDemocracy.